for aflcoaches.com.au and Chadforth Financial Group. This is a conversation with an AFL coach where we'll pick some of the leading footy brains in the land and have an in-depth chat covering their lives in and out of Aussie rules football.
Righto, we're talking to the great Chris Fagan. Thanks for coming in, Fakes.
Pleasure.
All the way from Brisbane. And we would like to start at the beginning, which ended up, by the way, as an induction in 2007 into the Tasmanian Footy Hall of Fame. 263 games, 430 goals, so you're obviously a really handy player. But just tell us, Hutchie and I were talking about off air, tell us about where your life and times, and particularly footy, started in Tassie.
Yes, Fakes, terrific to have you here, and I've heard you speak about this a little bit, and I know Queenstown's a really remote area of Tasmania, so let's start back there and what it was like and how it all happened for you and playing football on that gravel ground in the middle of nowhere and how you eventually were brave enough to get out of Queenstown.
It's a pretty remote town in Tasmania, copper mining town. Back then, there was a population of about 8,000 to 10,000 people. Back in the day, it's not so much now. If you went back there now, it's about 1,000 people because the prices of copper dropped in the late 70s and everyone left the town. But back when I was a kid, it was a big town. Had a lot of sport. Football was big. My dad was a coach in Queenstown of the Mountain Men, Gormanston. And I used to sort of travel along by his side to most training sessions. Much to my mother's disgust, learnt to swear pretty well at a very young age. the reason for the gravel ground was that Queenstown was a very wet place, and so turf didn't last for very long. It turned into mud quickly in the winter, so some wise person back in history decided to have a gravel ground there, which was worked pretty well in the wet. Didn't get too obviously muddy at all, but you had to wear bars on the bottom of your boots. You didn't wear stops because they wore down pretty quickly, so you had these bars.
Falling over?
The falling over bit, it was a bit tough because if you fell over, you ended up taking the skin off your knees or getting gravel rash or whatever. So if someone did the old sling tackle as you were about to hit the ground, you knew what was going to happen. So you learnt to keep your feet pretty well. But it was a terrific town in terms of being a young person because played all sport, cricket. Mind you, the cricket on the gravel oval, the new ball didn't last for too long. But basketball, footy. My first experience of playing footy was at St Joseph's Convent School, which is where I went to, and our coach there was one of the nuns, Sister Christopher, and she took us over to the oval every lunchtime, and we played games. We just played games. Every lunchtime we played games. And it's interesting when you look back the way coaching's turned out now. She was a genius because we all learnt game sense because we played games all the time. We didn't do drills. And so I don't think Sister Christopher's still alive, but if she was, I'd thank her for the great background that she gave us in footy. But we had a lot of fun. We'd run over to the oval. We'd have to get back before the bell went. By and large, most of us never got back before the bell went, so that meant you had to go upstairs and get the cuts, a couple for being late. That was life in that town. It was a lot of good people there. It could be a bit rough and tough. The men there were miners and they liked to drink and punt and do all those terrible things.
Now, Fakes, sorry, what age is this? So you're a young man.
Yeah.
Was it 12, 13, 14, 15?
Yeah, so yeah. I lived there for 15 years. So yeah. Basically did all my school schooling there until year 10 and then moved to Hobart to do year 11 and 12 on matriculation, as it was called back then. So
the move to Hobart, was that with your parents or you singly went yourself and got boarded and how did all that work for you?
No, well, I was going to go anyway and my parents, being the type of people that they are, didn't want the family to split up. So Dad finished up at the mine and Mum was a nurse at the hospital there and they moved to Hobart when I moved to Hobart fundamentally. So the family stayed together and I was able to do a year 11 and 12 down in Hobart and then went on to uni to do a teaching degree. So pretty fortunate in that regard. I mean, I was going to go anyway, but I was pretty glad that I could stick with my family. It made life just that bit easier.
Yeah.
Well, you've had a great career in Tassie. Were you good enough to play at the next level? I mean, there were Tasmanian players coming to the VFL in the 70s and early 80s. Tell us your career from that perspective.
Yeah, so I started playing senior footy in the state league down there when I was 16. I would have been a strapping 60 kilos.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty exciting thing to do. I had an opportunity to... I came over for a couple of practice games for Essendon. Would have been about 18 at the time. They just fly you over on the plane, put you in a hotel overnight, and you turn up and play in an under-19s practice game the next morning. You didn't know the name of one person, had no idea what the game plan was. Just went out there, had a couple of goes at that, but didn't get the opportunity to come over and play. I was at no draft or anything. That was a little bit different. They had so many form fours.
Yeah.
And so I ended up playing all of my career in the state league in Tassie, which was a lot of fun. It was a really strong competition back then, and had some good coaches along the way.
Yeah, and it was a significant competition because it was North and South, and great rivalry between the North teams and the South teams. And how did you find that, travelling every second week?
It was a lot of fun. In fact, in my career, I played with Hobart and Sandy Bay in the south, and then I spent 2 or 3 years at the end playing with Devonport, who were in the north of the state. So I got to experience footy at both ends and all the bias that existed in the rivalries.
They hate it, they
do to some degree. I could never quite understand it because they're all good blokes that I played with. But late in my career, I went to Devonport and played in a premiership side up there. It was like civil war. You know, we played Glenorchy in the grand final. The brawl breaks out before the bands got off the ground after they played the national anthem. It was just brutal. But really strong competition. I had some good coaches there. Paul Sproul coached me at Hobart, who'd been obviously a Richmond premiership player, and coached by Tommy Hafey, and a fellow by the name of Andy Bennett coached me at Sandy Bay, who was at Hawthorne, and being coached by Jeansy. So I was sort of exposed to some guys that knew a bit about coaching at a really early age, which was beneficial to me.
Do they pick your brain nowadays, the league, in terms of what's going on in Tassie footy? You and Bolts are two Tasmanians that have made it as senior coaches. What involvement, if any, do you have? And what do you think of the future of footy in Tassie at the moment?
Yeah, they formed a steering committee this year on Tassie footy, which myself and Bolts are actually on, which was great to be a part of, because we both...
You coached him,
really,
didn't
you? Yeah, I did coach Bolts as a 16, 17-year-old in the Tassie Mariners. Wow. And gave him a job at Hawthorn as coach of Box Hill. So, yeah, we go a long way back. But it was, good to work on that committee. Footy in Tasmania has probably declined a fair bit from where it was. Interestingly enough, its demise sort of comes on the back of the rise of AFL, because the people stopped going to the local football once there was a lot of AFL footy on TV. So that's hurt the competition a bit. Economically, probably the situation, Tassie blokes now probably don't want to play footy. They'd rather work on weekends and make a bit of coin. So that's detracted. And also, the clubs aren't as wealthy, and they haven't been able to attract blokes from the AFL to go down there and play and coach at the end of their careers, which was the norm as I was growing up. So it's fallen away a little bit. Then they lost the Mariners, which I thought was a bad thing for the state, because that was the one real connection to AFL footy that was there. And they haven't had the Mariners for quite some time, but I think after the work of the steering committee, they're going to come back on board pretty much full-time in the TAC Cup, which is exciting. I think there's still plenty of good footballers in Tassie. I think it's just a matter of putting the systems in place that allow those guys to come through. And, hopefully the work we've done this year will help footy. The AFL is going to tip some more money in, and hopefully it'll help Tassie footy get strong again.
Yeah. There's a bit of irony in this, folks, because I know when I got tipped out of Melbourne in the mid-'80s, Sandy Bay approached me to go and coach them. Yep. I thought, gee whiz, if I'd have gone down there, I might have coached a young Chris Fagan at some stage.
Oh, you would
there.
Have been. I was at Sandy Bay.
Yeah. So when did you get your head around thinking to coach? Because I know you did the teaching stuff. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, I've often thought about where did that come from. It's probably if I go back to Dad, hanging around with him when he was coaching Gormison all those years ago. I think I must have just liked the interaction he had with his players. A lot of them would come to our house and have dinner. He was a real relationship-based coach, and I guess I just got on the journey with him and sort of learned to love the game from a coaching perspective. And I think, almost the reason I wanted to become a teacher is because I like that idea of helping others, and coaching is just an extension of that purely in footy. So, that's where the real interest started. I had some good coaches along the way, like Sproul. He was a great mentor of mine and took a fair bit of interest in me, and I was always interested to see how he'd go about things. you know, same with Andy Bennett. And then I had a guy by the name of Roland Crosby who coached me at Devonport. And I sort of went up there late in my career, and he almost involved me as an assistant coach because I knew a lot about the competition back then. And, you know, he encouraged me, and I really enjoyed that part of the game. It sort of all grew from there. It was a bit of a natural extension, I think. And when you're a teacher, you coach the footy team at the school as well. Yeah. So I'd been doing that from the age of about 21. So had a lot of fun doing that. And, just naturally sort of progressed into coaching.
Yeah. Well, Roland Cosby is an example. Ex-Demon, finished playing Melbourne and went to Tassie and coached. Yeah, so...
Oh, did you know Crosser, do you?
Yeah, I know Crosser. Yeah,
he passed away a few years back.
Yeah, he did,
He's a good man.
Shepparton man.
Yep, that's him.
Yeah. You talked about teaching, Fags, and it's uncanny how many teachers, or how many that are the journey, wonderful coaches have been school teachers. Do you connect those dots, or is it just coincidence?
Oh, look, I think good coaches can come from anywhere. Key to it all is relationship building, but certainly when you go through your teacher training and you start to understand how people's minds work and what motivation looks like and all those sorts of things, it's a fairly natural extension, I think, to take that into coaching, whatever sport it may be. So there's a lot, the skill set's fairly similar. Mind you, look, I've worked with some teachers who aren't good teachers, so it can go that way too. But, you know, for me it was just fantastic preparation for what I've been able to do for the rest of my life. I sort of, every day I go to work, my favourite sport's footy, and I love teaching, so coaching is a fantastic job.
Righto, well, we're going to come back in a moment and talk about the transition from Tasmanian coaching to coaching at the Mighty Demons. We're talking to Chris Fagan for the Shadforth Financial Group.
The AFL Coaches Association has an important partnership with Shadforth Financial Group. Ask yourself four simple questions.
Do you know when you'll be debt-free?
If you died tomorrow, would your family be okay?
Do you know when you'll have enough money to retire?
Are you earning more than you spend?
If you answered no to any of those questions, you should talk to Shadforth, and quick.
Let's start with 19. I want to wind the clock back to 1997, and I'm joined by Greg Hutchison and Chris Fagan. Hutchie, why don't you tell it from your perspective? Because what we've got here is a freaky coincidence.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary chain of events, Mark. I'd been in the chair as a standing coach or temporary coach at Melbourne when Barmy got the sack, and Neil Danaher got appointed in 97, and we had to go through this process of trying to find a reserves coach, and we called for applications and the applications, and no doubt Fags will tell his story in a moment, but it was an exhaustive process, and I'd be interested to get Fags' views, and I've never spoken to him about it, but my recollection of it was it was very, very topical at the time, because we had an applicant who was a good personal friend of the current CEO, and when we made the appointment there, we got basically chastised for making the appointment. Fags, I saw your application when it came in, and it was really thorough, and give us your thoughts about how it all looked and how you ended up getting the job.
It was a big process. And look, to be honest with you, I was coaching the Tassie Mariners at the time, so I was working full-time in footy, and I just noticed that quite a few AFL clubs were looking for reserves and development coaches. It was sort of like at the time when they were starting to extend coaching groups, albeit they weren't as big then as they are now. And so I just sent my CV around to a whole lot of AFL clubs, just went on a fishing expedition really to see if there was any interest in this no-name from Tassie. And fortunately, Melbourne showed a bit of interest, and I was able to get an interview for the reserves and development coaching job there. I remember the interviews were at that, now the Pullman on
the
Park.
Hotel.
Yeah, I don't know what it was called back then. And I've never been so nervous in all my life. And I thought, oh, well, you know, at least this is a good experience. I probably won't get the job, but I've got the experience of going for an interview. And I think I walked in and you were there.
Yep.
And obviously Neil and Cameron Schwab.
Yep.
I think they were the three people that did the interviewing. I can't remember the questions that you asked me, but I can remember when I walked out thinking of all the answers when I walked out the door and thought, I botched that up, and I I rang my wife and I said, oh, she said, how'd it go? I said, oh, I don't think it went too well. I said, you don't have to worry. We're not going to move from Tassie, because she was pretty nervous about the whole thing. I said, it's been a good experience. So if I get another chance, I'll be better for it. And so I went away thinking, I'm not going to get this job. And I remember being on the Ferris wheel at the Royal Hobart show with my daughters. Then the phone goes and it's Neil on the phone. And he goes, oh, can you come back for a second interview? And I said, no worries, I'll come back for a second interview. And as it turned out, I think you'd made up your minds that I was going to be the person then. And the second interview ended up being the sort of, you've got the job, how are you going to get over here and all that sort of thing. But, I remember the one thing you had to do is you had to write a one page only on your philosophy for developing young players for AFL footy. And I sat out and wrote mine out of my head, what I thought. And it was actually really hard keeping it to one page. And I remember saying to Neil a few years later, I said, mate, can you tell me why you gave me that job? I said, because I can't figure, you know, why you gave it to him. And he just said, well, he said that one page document, he said, we sort of picked up from yours that you wrote yours, whereas a lot of the other ones looked like they'd been sort of copied out of the textbook. And yours was sort of the genuine one there. So that's the reason he gave you. But I was always puzzled by that decision, but very, very happy to get the job. And well, the first day at work, I was pretty intimidated walking into an AFL environment thinking, what the hell am I doing here? So
It was an extraordinary process. And the application, when Fakes' application came in, it was as thick as you're ever going to see. It covered everything, his history, philosophy, and it was outstanding. And you had to sort of say, well, we've got to speak to this bloke. And then during the interview process, and Fakes was really good, and he's right, we'd made up our mind about who we were going to appoint. But in the interim, we'd actually interviewed Chris Connolly for the same position. And it was a little bit different because Chris rolled in and he wanted the red carpet rolled out for him, and, you know, came in and was pretty gung-ho about the whole thing. And then when Chris found out that he wasn't getting the job and that we'd appointed this bloke, Chris Fagan, from Tassie, it was almost like World War III had happened. It was extraordinary, the impact that Neil and I got from Schwabie at the time. And how couldn't we appoint Chris Connolly? Anyway, the proof's in the pudding, because Fakes turned out to be a terrific coach.
Senior coaches.
But Fakes, what about the Junction Oval at the time? So we got you over from Tassie. You probably had better facilities at the Mariners. Got you over to the Junction Oval. Well, it's riddled with possums and rubbish. And it was...
Well, we used to clean the possum poo off your desk when you walk in, and come out of the roof. But
so you must have thought, what have I got myself into here?
Although I probably was that happy to have the job, I didn't notice those things too much. It probably was a bit different to what I expected an AFL club to be, because they were pretty average facilities, to say the least. Even the gym for the players and the locker room and everything was a bit of a battle. But what Neil and yourself were able to create over those years was a team that didn't worry about the facilities they had. There's a really good bond and a good group of blokes, and, you know, the team grew and developed and played in a lot of final series over that period of time. But it was different. I remember you, because I shared an office with you, had this big clunker of a desktop computer on there, and I wonder what the hell, how you use that and all that sort of business. But it took me about 4 to 6 weeks to get used to it. I remember Neil introduced me to the playing group, and I'm looking around, here's Gary Lyon and Jimmy Steins and Todd Viney, all these sort of legends in my mind. And Neil goes, he introduced me, he goes, do you want to say a few words? I'm thinking, not really. I think all I said was, I'm really happy to be here, and I hope I can earn your respect over the next little while. And that was it. That's all I said, because I was fairly intimidated at the time, thinking, what the hell am I doing here? So,
you talk about the facilities down there just then, you two recollecting it. Nothing's changed, has it? There's always a haves and a have-nots, and I gather at the Lions at the moment it's the same thing. In an arms race, you're coaching a team of players in facilities that aren't as good as the rest, or many, in the AFL. Can you recollect your time in the late 90s and position it now? I mean, how... This will never stop. There'll always be clubs that have got relatively poor facilities.
I think those experiences help you, though, because you rely on things that really matter. I mean, at the end of the day, facilities don't help you win premierships. It's about good coaching. It's about good relationships with your players. Sometimes it's good to not have the great facilities, because then you can have that bit of a backs-to-the-wall mentality, which North Melbourne had for years. So it sort of helps you, because you've got to rely on the pure things that coaching is all about, really. And it's still, at the end of the day, it's a people business. And it doesn't matter where your facilities are. If you get that bit right, you stand some sort of a chance.
And Fakes, you came in at a really good time because it was almost basically the start of full-time football.
And
Neil introduced the full-time program in January. We went down to Caulfield and that was the first full-time program that I'd been involved in. And he introduced his players and athletes and asked to what a full-time program could look like. And I don't know what you recall of it, but how much has it changed since that month in January 1998 to where you are now, 2018? Is there... I know it's a significant difference in whatever, but what were your thoughts then of full-time footy? What is it? How has it evolved?
Yeah, well, that full month that we did at Caulfield Grammar, I've never been so exhausted in all my life. Like we get there at 7 o'clock every day, and you know leave at 5 or 6 o'clock at the end of the day, and they were full days. I mean, probably even harder than what it is now. I mean, what's happened is, you know, we've become a bit more sensible and realise that players need a rest and staff need a rest, and you can't go from 7 till 5 every day flat out, filling every minute of every day. So we've become a little bit more sophisticated in the way we go about full-time footy. But back then it was quite revolutionary, and the amount of work that he himself put into cutting tape and showing how he wanted the game played, it was just it was like a full one-month PD exercise for me. I don't know how you felt, but that's what it was like. And the players, I think, were a bit stunned. And they, like us, at the end of it, they were pretty worn out. But it was at the end of it, you knew exactly what he wanted. And I think it gave us an edge going into that season.
Oh, no doubt. And his work, like as you said, it went from 7 until 5:30 every day. But his ability to then go home and actually cut the vision, to have vision ready for the next couple of days ahead. And we then played the pre-season games and we went to Wellington and we smashed the Swans down there. And that was the start of, or I'm sure that was the start of 98, and then they played in the preliminary final. He really set the whole tone and did a terrific job, and we're really fortunate to be a part of that.
Yeah, I reckon you're right, because I mean, I don't know what it was like at other clubs, but I reckon he was probably ahead of his time in that regard, because footy had only just started to become full-time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took it to a new level.
Mm. I want to talk about 2000, which was a highlight, of course, for the Demons getting in it, but it was a dreadful flogging. What do you recollect about that game, and then how did you react? What are your recollections of the build-up and then the loss? Because it was a long time coming. 88, I think, was the previous time the Demons had made the grand final. So tell us about what that was like. Bittersweet, I suspect.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was an interesting season, because at the halfway mark, the D's weren't even in the eight. I think we might have lost 3 games in a row by somewhere around 100 points. And backs to the wall, all the media were hanging around down at the Junction Oval, smelling a little bit of blood, and then suddenly we got going, and I think might have won 8 of our last 9 games to sort of sneak into the top 4 somehow, and then played, I think it was Carlton in a final that they were red hot favourites for, and I think we came from about 5 goals down halfway through the third quarter to win that game. A young Brad Green kicked 4 goals after half time, I reckon. Cameron Bruce would have been another young player in that side, and then I think the next that got us through to the prelim, and we played North.
Played North.
And were able to win that, and then obviously got into the grand final against a rampaging Essendon side. They'd been tough to beat all year. I think they'd lost the last home and away game, didn't they, to the Bulldogs, who played an 18-man zone in the back half of the ground, did something unique to beat them. But, it was so exciting to make that grand final. I still remember the getting in the cars and going on the grand final parade and 10,000 people turning up to the Junction Oval for training, and it felt like you were sort of living this dream. But the Essendon side had a few disappointments over the previous seasons, and they were hardened, cold-hearted professionals, and you know, we had a really young side, and they smashed us physically in the first quarter of that game. It was really all over by quarter time, unfortunately. I still look back on that and think that was just a marvellous coaching effort by Neil to get that team to the grand final, because there's probably no, with all due respect to those blokes, no way they were the second best team in the comp that year, but they got there and were not good enough in the grand final, but still a magnificent effort.
Yeah, it's significant, because when you consider at the end of 99, they made the finals, made the prelim in 98, went down in 99, and then retired, Neil and yourself retired Lyon, Viney, Glenn Lovett. So three significant people at the footy club. The reserves competition also finished, so your role would have changed from coaching the reserves to becoming a genuine assistant coach.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a big change from the end of 99 to where they got to in 2000. It was an incredible coaching performance.
Nietzsche became captain and led the team really well. Shane Wywoden won the Brownlow that year.
Yeah.
And a bit like the D's of this year, had tremendous momentum coming into finals. So,
And your role game day in that, because it, I know when also we have different roles game days, but your role, from my recollection, was you got to send the messages. So how did that come about? Is that right or not?
Yeah, I think that's what I did. It's a fair while ago. Yeah. I think I was sending the messages because Neil could get fired up at times, and he wasn't very good at sending the messages. So I had to decipher what it was he was trying to do and let the runner know, which could, you know, was be quite amusing at times. But yeah, I did my best at that. I ended up doing the same thing for Clarko at Hawthorn for 9 years, so pretty experienced at that role. And now that I'm a coach myself, I get someone else to send the messages. It's fantastic.
I watched the Demons during that period of time as a friend of Neil's, having worked with him at Fremantle, and I thought to myself, the smell of an oily rag. You also had sort of, I'd have to say, instability. I remember Joe Gutnik was a powerful, at times disruptive, it looked at least from the outside. I'm fascinated in your interpretation of that, because later on it became apparent to me that alignment is critical between the footy department, CEO, board, but particularly the chairman. And I didn't see a lot of that. I might be completely wrong, but I thought to myself, not only is Neil doing a great job for the reasons you've articulated, but what was the club like at that time? And then, you know, you then went to Hawthorn and now you're at Brisbane and you've got plenty of experience. But at the time, did you sense a disconnect?
Yeah, well, there was a geographical disconnect in a sense too, because the administration of the footy club was at the MCG and the football department was at the Junction Oval. So there was this sort of natural division. And to a degree, I must admit, in the 10 years I was there, we sort of battened down the hatches a fair bit and just ran our own show as a football department. And whilst we still worked in with the rest of the club, we felt like we're our own entity. And you're right, there were some Joe Gutnik, some big figures that were in charge of the footy club and probably didn't understand footy clubs a great deal. So we just took it upon ourselves to go about it in that manner. And I probably realised just how different it was when I did go to Hawthorn, and you went to a club that was all at the one facility out at Waverley Park. There was a feeling of oneness in the whole place. You know, you worked in with the people in admin because they were there every day. It did make me look back on Melbourne and marvel at just how well we were able to survive during that period of time with not much money either. That was always an issue with the D's, as you remember, Hutchie. It was tough financial times. It was that era just post the idea that the club might amalgamate with Hawthorn. So the Hawks sort of went from strength to strength, but Melbourne still struggled and probably still struggling a little bit today, probably going better, but it's been a long, long process for the D's, which is why it's so good to see them in finals this year.
And tell us a little bit about Travis Johnson, David Swartz, Jeffrey Farmer, terrifically talented people, players, but unique characters as well.
they all were unique in their own way. There are a few down at the D's. Wizzy was a ripper. Like, I just loved watching him play. He could do anything, that guy.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that mark that he took. I've never seen a bloke get up so high. Was that in a final or was it a game against Richmond? I think it was a home and away game. Wizzy always enjoyed a drink after the game and would often turn up a little bit shabby on on Mondays. He loved his cricket. He thought he was Sachin Tendulkar. And because obviously down at the Junction Oval we had the nets there, he'd be often out there having a bit of a hit, but always had a smile on his face and enjoyed his footy and a tremendous natural football. It was a sad day for the D's when he went back to Frio, I thought, because he was definitely one of our competitive advantages. Swarter was a larger-than-life character. Obviously had his issues with the gambling and all that sort of business, but seems like he's got his life in order. But for a bloke that had all those knee reconstructions, he was a pretty special sort of a player. Could be a little bit hard to coach sometimes, a bit stubborn. But I always found him, he was good to me. I coached the forwards for a long time at the D's, and he was part of that group and always really helpful. And Travis Johnson, well, Travis was the number one pick when I first turned up, bit of a knockabout lad, still is a knockabout lad, I think. I remember my wife and I going for a walk down Chapel Street one Friday night, and Travis spotted us from a bar that he was in, came running out. He had the big beard. He was almost unrecognisable, but a fantastic young fellow, a brilliant talent, a beautiful kick. Used to get him into trouble sometimes, though, because he could he'd try to thread the eye of the needle with some of his kicks. But, yeah, all really talented players and enjoyable to coach and kept life interesting.
So he had a 10-year career at the Demons, I found out the other day, which culminated in life membership at the club, which must make you feel great. How did you go from the Demons to the Hawks?
Yeah, that was an interesting process. I knew Clarko from my early Melbourne days. He was our runner, wasn't he, Hutch? And did a few other things around the club. Had been retired prematurely by Neil, but kept on in a bit of a capacity. So got to know him, and he got appointed as coach of Hawthorn in 2005 or something like that, I think, six, around that time. Yeah. Clarko was interested in sort of having a position there at the club that was called Head of Coaching and Development, which is really around helping in the development of the coaches as well as the setting up a development program for the players at Hawks at the time. And at the end of 2006, I sort of had a quite clandestine meeting with Mark Evans and Clarko at Waverley Park at about 10 o'clock at night, because I said I wouldn't come during the day. I didn't want anyone to see me. And I went out. Jason Dunstall was part of that meeting, and they sort of showed me what the role entailed, and was pretty exciting sort of a role, because I was footy manager by that time at Melbourne, and probably loved the coaching more than the footy manager stuff. And so I went and listened to them. Sounded like a fantastic job, but Neil was coming into the last year of his contract at the Hawks, at the D's, and I was hoping that he would do well and that we continue at Melbourne. So I knocked back the job at Hawthorn and to stay at Melbourne, and by halfway through the next season, Neil had pulled the pin, and I'm thinking, oh, I probably should have taken that job at Hawthorn. And look, fortunately enough, I reckon Mark Evans rang me a day later after Neil resigned and said, that job that we talked to you about last year, we didn't fill it, and if it's there for you at the end of this year, if you'd like to come. And I said, well, there's nothing holding me here now, so yeah, I'll come. So I finished off the year at the D's as footy manager, and then moved to Hawthorn at the end of 07 to take up that role. And, you know, little did I know,
I'm going to win a premiership.
Well, not only one, but, you know, four in the time that I was there, and played in five grannies. So that was a fortuitous move, I think.
Hell of a good move. Fascinated. I mean, we've had this little journey. We're talking to Chris Fagan, the senior coach of the Mighty Lions. Started out on the gravel in Western Tasmania. You go to the Mighty Hawks in 2008. A partnership with you and Alistair, which we'll talk about a bit later, emerges. Wonderful. And you win four flags over that journey. There must have been times when you're getting in the car or driving home or sitting in a plane or talking to your mates from Tassie, just pinching yourself at how the journey had taken you to this position in an almost unprecedented era of dominance. Tell us what your emotions like and how much fun were you having at the time?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a surprise. I knew Hawthorn were a team on the rise, but I didn't think for one moment the first year that I'd go there that we'd, you know, beat Geelong in a grand final. So that was amazing, especially after the Melbourne experience where Eston belted us that year. And we went into that game against Geelong in pretty similar circumstances. They'd been the best team all year. They were red-hot favourites. And I remember driving to the game that day thinking, oh, I don't know how we'll go today, you know. Probably they'll win, you know. Yeah, you think like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we kicked absolutely straight. Geelong kicked absolutely crooked, and we pinched the grand final. We probably should never have won. It was probably the most exciting. Well, it wasn't. It was the most exciting sporting day in my life to be involved in that victory. Pinching myself, I thought, gee, this is a young group. We've probably got a chance to do this a bit more often. But it took. We missed the finals in 2009. Got knocked out in the first week in 2010. Beaten in the prelim in 2011, beaten in the granny in 2012, and I was starting to wonder whether it was going to happen again. And then you hit this era where you win three in a row, and they're all sort of under different circumstances, but nevertheless exciting. And you look back on it now and you have a bit of a chuckle. And it's funny, when you in 2016, when we actually got beaten by the Bulldogs in that final, was like, you felt pretty flat. But then when you look back, you go, got nothing much to complain about here. Not too many blokes get the opportunity to play, to be involved in five grand finals and win four of them. We have led a very fortunate life at the Hawks, you know.
What happened after in 2009? Go back to the 2009. You've had that surprise win. I mean, again, sitting on the outside, everyone thought, well, gee, they're ahead of what looked to be an upwards graph, but then it was sort of an embarrassing fall out of the eight, am I right, in 2009?
Yeah, we finished about 10th, I reckon. I think if you talk to Clarko about this, he'd say the same thing. But when we looked back on that, the club probably wasn't, in a sense, ready to win that premiership. And I think,
what do you mean?
I think all of us were pretty carried away by it, and the players had a very good off-season and didn't turn up in the greatest of shape when they came back. We also got some injuries out of that grand final, guys like Trent Crowe, who I don't think he ever played another game of AFL football after that grand final, so there was a few serious injuries, but by and large the boys didn't turn up in great shape. They probably thought, a bit of complacency set in, they probably thought it was just going to happen because they were a young group. Geez, we know we've won this, it'll just keep going, and it didn't. And that coupled with injury and during the season, not being as fit as we should have been at the start, led to that year in 2009 where we missed out. It was a valuable learning experience, because certainly when the team won in 2013, Clarko and I were able to go back to 2008 and go, boys, because a lot of those lads were still there. Remember what happened back then? And there was that was the great thing about that group. They were hungry to win more, and they turned up in great shape after each of those premierships, having learned that lesson back in 2008.
And you lost in 2012.
Yep.
Against a horse. Alistair's very, very close mate. So I'd imagine by beginning of 2013, you're just wanting to eat a footy at pre-season.
Yeah, it was a bitter pill to swallow, losing that grand final. It was a little bit different to the Melbourne one. We lost where we were, a long way behind Essendon, whereas Hawks have been the best team in the comp in 2012 all the way through. And that grand final, to Sydney's credit, they played fantastically well. Hawks kicked really poorly for goal. We had like 70 entries inside 50, and the Swans were just able to pick us off and get us on the rebound. And it was tremendously disappointing, but also it proved to be a period of great growth for the Hawks. Because when you lose, you look harder at your losses than you do at your wins. And it made us reflect and look back on a number of things, and which we were then able to improve over that pre-season, and I think it held us in good stead and provided the hunger for those three in a row. I'm sure of that. I'm not certain that if the Hawks had a one in 2012 that the three in a row would have happened. It may have ended up four in a row. We always talk about that. It should have been four in a row, but maybe it wouldn't have been if we hadn't have had that bit of disappointment, because that sort of steels you and hardens you, I reckon, to get better.
Really significant role that you would have played with Mark Evans in that time. And Alistair, we know, is an outstanding coach, but we also know he's a feisty character. How did you go managing Alistair in that period of time? And not managing him sitting over, but working with him to get the most out of him so as you could get the most out of your players.
I think we just had a good understanding of each other, and we were a bit yin and yang. He could be feisty, and I understood that, and I sort of accepted that in a way, that was just him. And he also knew that I could be calm, and maybe we'd get him just to slow down a fraction on things and think a little bit more about it. And I respected him, and he respected me. And I think between the two of us, most of the time, we're able to, get a pretty good balance and keep things cool. From time to time, he'd fire up and do a few things. But that's sort of Clarko, and that's why his players love him. I mean, he's so loyal to the Hawks and the players there, and wants to get the best out of them. And, when he's in your corner, you know that he's going to protect you all the way. So, fantastic partnership with him. It wasn't without its arguments, and we would debate things behind closed doors and get a bit angry with each other from time to time. But by and large, we were always both interested in the well-being of the footy team and what was best for the club. And most of the time, we'd come up with the right solutions.
Tell me, why do you think Alistair's had so many, and you're one of them now, the most recent, so many of his underlings have gone out and become, very successful senior coaches? It's quite remarkable. You guys have been around game longer than me, but I can't think of anyone that's been as productive in terms of generating senior coaches.
Partly it's to do with the fact that the team's been so successful, so people want to want to find out, can they get a little bit of a part of that success into their footy club? So by and large, the six of us who have gone on to coach elsewhere have been lucky that we've been involved in Hawthorn from that perspective. But if I just look at the environment itself, it was a really good learning environment. And if you're a coach, and I think I described it when I first got the job at RISM, it was almost like a football university at Hawthorn. We learn off each other. It was that sort of environment that was created there. And I think that helped all of us to become better coaches and grow in the time that we were there. It was almost like you didn't need to go out and do professional development to a degree, because we were challenging each other and pushing each other all the way. And it was just one of those things where it was just a good collection of people. And it's been over a period of years. As Dimmer was there early days. You know, then Leon turned up from the, I think he'd been at the Doggies. Obviously, Simo just out of playing. Bevo had been at Collingwood, and Bolts, well, he was from Tassie and coached Box Hill, and he worked his way through in a different way. So,
but you talk about I think you're being a bit underselling yourself, because the Hawks had a reputation, or certainly Alistair did, for travelling around the world, coming back with these new ways of looking at sport and coaching and invasion sports in particular. So you must have, well, it sounds like you had a culture where you could talk and challenge one another, but there was, you know, seemed to me there was a lot of new, fresh ideas.
Oh, yeah, we did do that as well. I mean, fortunately, Hawthorn was a wealthy enough club to allow us coaches to go off and look at different things around the world. Professional development was certainly a part of it, but I think then that the coaching group we had the talent to come back and put some of those things in place that we saw in the AFL context. Not every coach went away every year, but Clarko certainly did. He used to use up all the budget dollars, so we have to take it in turns. But I think he found that just a great time to get away from the hurly-burly of AFL, relax a bit and learn and refresh as well. So,
staying with the topic of all of you leaving the cradle of Hawks and going out, what are you like? What's it like now? I'm fascinated to know whether there's friendships amongst the six or seven of you. It was terrific to see Alistair and Dimmer have a big hug the other day. I'm not a great hugging bloke, but they really hugged each other. And you could sense that it's a big game and we're going to be at each other's throat. But it was just fantastic. And I won't forget, I'm sure Dimmer won't either, when the Tigers won a flag, the first person to meet him after the press conference was Alistair. When you guys coach against one another and you see each other out on the ground, or you're leading up to the game, or you're afterwards at the press conference, what's it like amongst the six, or all of your coaches, but particularly those of you that started out the journey at Waverley with the Hawks?
Yeah, this is just from my perspective. We're all still good friends. We love it when we catch up and chat about footy and all sorts of things, and we sort of all know each other's families as well, which is nice, and watching our kids grow up. Mine are a bit older than most of theirs, but yeah, that's been good. For me personally, I'd rather not see them before the game. You know, so I'll avoid as much as I can. I can't speak for the others, but I don't think I've spoken to any of them prior to a game. But certainly after the game, when we see each other socially anywhere, just like we're old workmates that spent had a few battles together. So,
do you ever ring one another and say, "Oh, I've got a game against, we're playing the Eagles this week, Bevo. Come on, you look like, you know." Do you get any insight from one another? And just as you answer that, how would you think the twins, Chris and Brad, go? You know, given the
look, a little bit of that happens, but I reckon it all depends on how far away our next game v them is. Yeah. Because if you start asking questions about things, you're giving a little bit away, a little bit of what you do yourself. Yeah. So, you know, probably it's more likely to happen, say, if, you know, we'd played Carlton in round two, Brisbane played Carlton in round two, and we weren't going to play each other for the rest of the year, we'd probably be more inclined to help each other out than if we were knowing there was another battle coming up somewhere down the track. So a little bit of that goes on, not a heap, but a little bit,
We saw how Clarko and yourself dealt with that. How did he deal with Franklin leaving then?
Yeah, it was disappointing that when we lost Bud, because he was such a big part of what we'd been able to achieve. He played in three of the grand finals. He won two of them. But to be honest with you, as much as it was disappointing for us to lose him, Clarko's had always asked the players there, because they're a really talented group, to play for less to get success. So that meant they paid for less money than what they probably get elsewhere. And Sydney had made Buddy an unbelievable offer, which was way and above what any Hawthorn player was getting paid at the time. And in a sense, it was so philosophically against what Clarko had asked the other players to do that it sort of became a no-brainer in the end, that he sort of had to go because we were never going to offer him that money to stay, because it would have meant we had to lose other players off the list and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, good luck to him. I think he was finding the bubble of Melbourne life pretty tough as well. So in the end, it was probably a win-win for everyone. It didn't stop the Hawks from going on and winning the next two premierships, and Bud played in one of those grand finals, so yeah. Sydney would have been hoping for the same result. But by and large, you know, Bud still has a lot of strong friendships at Hawthorn, and he will let forever be a Hawthorn legend and a legend of the game. So in the end, it was probably a happy decision for all of us.
Yep. We're talking to Chris Fagan, the coach of the Brisbane Lions. When we come back, we're going to leap from the Hawthorn Footy Club to the mighty Brisbane Lions Footy Club.
The AFL Coaches Association has an important partnership with Shadforth Financial Group. Ask yourself four simple questions.
Do you know when you'll be debt-free?
If you died tomorrow, would your family be okay?
Do you know when you'll have enough money to retire?
Are you earning more than you spend?
If you answered no to any of those questions, you should talk to Shadforth, and quick.
Welcome back. This is Mark Brayshaw and Greg Hutchison from the AFL Coaches Association. We're having a conversation with Chris Fagan, who started in Tasmania, and now we want to talk to him about his appointment as coach of the Brisbane Lions. Justin Lepich gets the flick late in 2016. How did it unravel for him and ravel for you?
Yeah, well, the first I sort of knew about Brisbane's interest in me, because it came as a bit of a shock. I was general manager of footy at Hawthorn, and I got a phone call from Greg Swan, the CEO of Brisbane, and he said, are you a coach or are you a footy manager? And I said, oh, deep down I'm a coach. And he said, oh, would you be interested in applying for our senior coaching position? So I said, I'll give it some thought. Probably need to meet with you and find out a bit about the club before I throw my hat in the ring. So I ended up having a chat with Swanee and Peter Swab, who was the list manager at the time, out at my place, out at Box Hill, and decided I thought, well, I'm 55, I've always wanted to do this, I might as well have a crack at the process and see how I go. So I had to go through an interview process. Yep. Yeah, it felt like back in those early days, Hutch, when I got my job at Melbourne. I don't think I'd been through an interview process at all since then. And yeah. I'd been through a few on the other side of the table where we were interviewing, whether it be assistant coaches or whatever. So I was back to being nervous again, like that 35-year-old back in 1997.
What were your first impressions when you got the job?
First impressions, I interviewed all the players one by one when I first got the jobs to try and get a picture of what was really happening at the club. And, you know, it wasn't a good time for the Brisbane Lions Footy Club for whatever reason. The players had a pretty negative idea of what an AFL club was and felt like. The first training session, I think there was about 35 players at training. There was probably 24 of them in rehab, which no one told me. I didn't realise they were all injured. I was stupid enough not to ask that question about the health of the list. But I remember thinking that morning, gee, it's going to be a long process and hard work to get these boys back to being competitive again. Because, you know, I was comparing everything to Hawthorn at the time, which is so natural enough to do. And
just on that point, I'd imagine there's a bit of a conflict here. On the one hand, you're trying to win the job by being as optimistic and positive as possible. But the flip side of that is you must have known that it's going to be a very challenging assignment, no matter who got the job. And we go back to this question of alignment. Did you try and balance frightening Swanee and the board into a reality check that might have cost you the job, or did you want to oversell and then underdeliver later? Tell us whether or not that was an issue.
No, in the interview, I'd done a fair bit of work on their list and where I thought it was at, and I thought it was it's going to take 5 years to try and...
And you told them that?
Yeah, Brisbane back to where they... to being competitive again. But the funny part about it is that the club was at a really low ebb, but that's where... To me, that's where I saw the opportunity, because there are lots of areas where you can make improvement relatively quickly, and so I've always been a bit of an optimist... There have been probably times over the last couple of years where that optimism's been tested, been tested a bit. But, you know, by and large, you know, most things have gone to plan, albeit we would have liked to have won a few more games this year. We had a lot of close losses, but there's a good vibe around the club. We've got a terrific group of young players. Everyone's bought into the processes and the culture that we've tried to put in place.
What about Lee Matthews? Tell me, yeah. Give us an insight. He's the biggest name in the game. He's a director of the club, and if I'm a betting man, I'd imagine he'd have a line of sight across most of the things that happen in the footy department and coaching. How do you get along with him, and what role, if any, did he have in your appointment?
Yeah, Lee wasn't part of the interview process, so he probably didn't have a lot to do with my appointment. But I will say, in the 2 years that I've been in Brisbane, he's been a fantastic mentor for me. He lives just around the corner, and we meet regularly on a Tuesday night for a steak down in Oxford Street,
right,
with his wife Deb and Ursula, and those two talk about lady stuff, and Lee and I talk about footy stuff and coaching, and he's been great because he's been through it. He understands all the emotions that go with coaching, all the issues that you have. He still watches us play closely, so he's got opinions on the way that we play and some of our players and all that sort of business. So I consider myself fortunate that I can have regular dialogue with him. He's a really balanced person. And even though I'm old at 57 and I've been around the block a few times, it's still good to talk to somebody who's been through it and understands the Brisbane marketplace and what's involved in coaching up there. And I'd have to say that Alistair Lynch and Jonathan Brown have been equally as good as past players. So they're three guys I talk to on a regular basis. And you know, not only do they give you good advice, because they work in the media, they're able to tell Brisbane's story a little bit, which I think is important when you're going through that stage where you're trying to rebuild a footy club. They help, I think, engender patience amongst our supporters, knowing that we are going through a process and it's going to take a little bit of time.
There are three good people to have on side, Fakes, described as a Brisbane mafia by a lot of people going around. Point of difference, why did they pick you? You know, you talk about philosophies and what you stand for as a coach, but why did Brisbane pick you?
Oh, look, you'd probably have to ask the people that picked me.
But my
guess is the club was a bit fractured at the time and lacked a lot of belief and probably had a few things to my advantage. I'd been at Hawthorn, I was experienced, and probably if you ask people who know me, they'll probably say that I'm a good relationship builder, and I've sort of got a bit of an ability to bring people together, which I think is what they felt was needed at the time. I mean, I'll be the first to admit I'm not necessarily the sharpest bloke tactically on match day, but I've got other people on our coaching staff who are fantastic at that, people like Danny Daly. And coaching an AFL team now is very much a team effort, and the head coach is more the people manager, in a sense, if you like, although there are probably some coaches who are more bent towards the game itself and the tactic and the strategy. But for me, it was and I think for Brisbane at the time, it was all about rebuilding belief and faith and confidence and all those sorts of things, and they needed somebody who had some skills in that area to do it, I think. And, you know, just now we're at the point 2 years in where we're getting a bit more pointy and cutting edge with what we need to do, and we've able to focus more on the way we play the game and the tactics and strategies involved. So hopefully that continues to grow over the next few years.
I'm interested in the how you've tackled the go-home factor, which was a real curse for Brisbane. Mm. You mentioned your life and time starting out in, way, way west and very remote Tassie. And as a 15-year-old, you went down to the big smoke. Does that resonate when you've got a young kid who's taken his family and all his life, typically on his own, from a potentially remote part of Australia to Brisbane? Because it seems like you've done a pretty good job turning around the go-home factor. Mm. Is that just a fanciful interpretation of your own experience?
Oh, no, I think all those experiences help. I mean, the first year you move anywhere, you feel like a fish out of water. I did last year as coach of Brisbane, but I went through what the first-year recruits went through last year, and Ursula, my wife, has to move up there. We leave our two daughters in Melbourne. Everything that you're comfortable with suddenly is taken away from you. So in a sense, me making that move last year, I actually understand what those new recruits are going through, and sometimes you just need someone to talk to about that. So I do a lot of talking with those first-year boys just to make sure that they understand I know where they're at and we can get them help if they're struggling. It's only natural. But what I think overall, you know, Brisbane's a tough marketplace in that it's not an AFL town. It's not like Melbourne where everyone talks about it, everyone's into it. You feel like you're some sort of a celebrity, I guess, if you're an AFL player down here. In Brisbane, you're lucky if they, you know, the diehard AFL people know, but the rest of them don't. So that has its challenges. So what you need to do is try and make the club as good a place as it can be for the players to come to and feel like they're improving on a regular basis. So we've gone to great lengths to make sure they understand they are improving. And that's not easy to do when you're not winning a whole lot of games of footy, but we use the different stats with them to show the progression of the team, and they can clearly see what's going on. They all feel like they're getting better as footballer and as people, which is really important. The people bit's real important. I think they're the things that you rely on. I mean, you can't, in the end, you can't throw money and all sorts of other incentives. It's just, if it's a good place to come to, they'll have a tendency to stay and want to do well there. If it's not, I want to go.
I'm also interested in the contrast between the very wealthy, very successful, everything that opens and shuts Hawks and the Lions that don't have a lot of that. You've got to have a can-do mentality, I imagine. There's got to be a positive sense that, hey, don't worry, despite the fact that we're small and remote and not as much money. How have you managed that? Because as footy manager of the Hawks, you'll have been acutely aware of the economic advantage they have. I mean, I heard somebody say the other day that one of the interstate clubs, the non-Victorian clubs, that plays Sunday afternoons, you know, there's just another dimension of stress to the fact that you don't get a break, you don't get the weekend. What are the differences between a huge, successful club in Melbourne and the one you're at the moment? And not so much the obvious, but what has surprised you about the challenge that faces you and that you need to really sort of squarely look at and overcome?
Yeah, well, one of those things you just touched on, you know, we play a lot of Sunday games and often interstate, and so you get back late on Sunday night and the working week starting again on the Monday. You know, when at the Hawks, you played so many games on a Friday night or a Thursday night that the players and the whole club would often get a rest every second or third weekend. Well, it doesn't happen in Brisbane. We play Saturdays or Sundays, and we play a lot of Sundays and interstate. So you just adapt to your environment. So, like, for us, for instance, I wouldn't be asking the coaches to come in at 8 o'clock on Monday morning with all their work done. I'll say, I'll see you at 3. And give them a bit of time, and I'll say to the players, I'll see you Tuesday. Do your own recover, and we'll see you Tuesday. Because you need to. One of the biggest things is keeping energy in your organisation. And I reckon if you burn the candle too much, the air goes out of everyone's tyres, and they get tired, and it's hard to keep that energy up. So that's one of the little adaptations that you make. You know, the funny thing that I don't feel that Brisbane, like, we go without anything much.
So not lavish camps or extra physios, that sort of thing?
It's probably all that, but it's almost, sometimes it's a perception thing at those clubs that they feel like they haven't got a lot of things that the other richer clubs have. Now, we haven't got brilliant facilities. They are a little bit old at the Gabba, and in the summer we have to train at different venues because we can't train at the Gabba, and all that's a bit of a pain in the backside, to be honest. It'd be nice to be at Waverley Park and just go out and train on your oval. But in terms of staff, programs, all those sorts of things, we don't really go without. We don't have too many of the extra bells and whistles, but in terms of the cold hardcore things that you need to run a footy program, we've got all those things. We've got a good quota of coaches. Our medical staff are fantastic. One of the things I had to do when I first got to Brisbane was say to the players, "Hey boys, you're not missing out on that much. You might think that you are, but you're not." Now, I've been at Hawthorn. In terms of staff, we're just as well off here. We haven't got the great facility, but that's in the pipeline up there at the moment. And I said, "And anyway, it's not an excuse for failure. It's all about what happens within these four walls, not how much money we've got to spend on extra things." So, you know, we don't go on overseas training camps. We go to Tassie and stay at the university accommodation there and train on, you know, the oval in Launceston. But we've got so much out of there anyway. It's all people stuff. So we'll continue down that pathway. And I know, like, having spent 10 years at the Hawks, they've got lots of things there. But by and large, the reason that they're successful is not about that. It's about the interaction between the people and how they work with and for each other and how everyone plays their role and all that sort of stuff. And that doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic insight, folks, and it's something that you've taken with you all the way through. It's just not a silly question, but basically then, what do you stand for as a coach? It's all about relationships and treating the people fairly and looking after them. And
yeah, definitely that. It's definitely relationships. It's about being open and honest, and I reckon the coach has got to set the example there. We always talk about having open and honest environments, but unless the people who are in charge set the example in that regard, I don't think that really happens. So I regularly get feedback from my players on my performance. It's not done privately. I'll stand there and let them talk about those things. Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They're really good.
What can you tell us, just what's the most crunching feedback that you've got from your coaches? Your players that you're comfortable sharing with us?
Oh, yeah. One of the ones I've gotten all my life, I've tried to work on it, is when I'm really focused on something, I sort of get this look on my face and I'm a little bit not very approachable, or it seems that way. So they'll challenge me on that one. And I just say to them, listen, boys, don't worry about it. You can come and talk to me. I just get locked away in my thoughts, and it might look like that, but it's not actually the case. And the other one is, and I think this is a real challenge for all AFL senior coaches, is that the guys that play in the reserves always feel like you don't communicate with them enough. And I agree with that criticism, but it's a time management thing. And there are 46 of them. And when you start the season, the 22 blokes that play in the AFL team that weekend get a lot more of your attention than the blokes that play in the NEAFL, for instance. So I accept that feedback, and we'll keep trying to find ways where they feel like they're getting as much feedback as they need. But they'd be the two biggest ones for me.
Now, folks, I know you work incredibly hard, and you spoke about the Sunday night games and telling your staff to get in it, you know, do the stuff by three, and the players don't want to see you till Tuesday. But you do work incredibly hard, and it's as a senior coach, how do you keep yourself fresh and healthy and invigorated, ready to go? Because it's easy to put your head down and be on the treadmill all the time, but how do you do it and make sure that you're at your very best come game day?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. The first thing you have to do is understand that sometimes thinking about things over and over and over again doesn't make you a better coach, that you actually got to have times where you do some other things and give your mind a rest, because often it's in those moments that the good idea will come into your head. So for me, it's sort of exercise. I have a hit of golf occasionally with Lynchy on a Wednesday. You know, go to the movies, try and do normal things. I should have known that, but I know the first half year that I coached Brisbane, I was working ridiculous hours and not giving myself a break from anything. And by the time I got to the halfway mark of the year, I'm thinking, oh, God, it's a long way to go. I've got to be better at giving myself a spell. So I went and saw a person who's an expert in that area about it, try and help me with that. That's probably the most valuable lesson I've learned. I've got to keep if I want everyone else's energy up, I've got to keep mine up. So you've got to give yourself breaks. So whether that's through exercise or going to the movies, and making sure that when the season's over that you do have a good break away from the hurly-burly and don't think about footy. It actually is good fertility for your mind, if you know what I mean. And I'm a big walker. I'll walk a lot and, you know, listen to music and walk and have ideas. And I've just learned to relax, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Who amongst your coaching staff pulls your coat?
They probably all do, because like the players, I get regular feedback from them as well on how I'm going. But I suppose if I was to nominate a person, it'd be Danny Daly. Danny's been around a long time and coached himself, I think, in Bolwyn or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
He's obviously been at North Melbourne and at Richmond and been at Brisbane for a while, and he's a pretty wise sort of a guy. He keeps an eye out for me. He's the one that will send me a text to see how I'm going, or if he knows I've had a day of, you know, four or five times a year I catch up with every player one-on-one for 20 minutes or so. And I usually just knock them over in one day. So I'll start at 8 in the morning and finish around 8 or 9 at night. The first person to call me when I'm in the car on the way home is Danny to see how I'm going. And, you know, so...
Yeah, you're lucky to have a...
Yeah, and I don't ask him to do that. He just does it. And that's the sort of person that he is. And I think everyone needs someone like that by their side. I was probably that person for Clarko at Hawthorn, and I appreciate what Danny does for me.
The AFL Coaches Association has an important partnership with Shadforth Financial Group. Ask yourself four simple questions.
Do you know when you'll be debt-free?
If you died tomorrow, would your family be okay?
Do you know when you'll have enough money to retire?
Are you earning more than you spend?
If you answered no to any of those questions, you should talk to Shadforth and quick.
Mark Brayshaw and Greg Hutchison having a winding up, actually, a fabulous conversation with Chris Fagan, coach of the Lions. A couple of questions in summary, Fags. You've had a... It just occurred to me looking at the notes. You were in the AFL system, for 20 years, I think, or 19 seasons prior to getting the job.
Yep.
You coached in Tasmania beforehand. That's a heck of an apprenticeship, and the industry is unanimously acknowledging the wonderful job you're doing. What advice have you got for young coaches in light of those 20 odd years? And at the same time, even despite the fact that you've had this wonderful apprenticeship, what caught you off guard? What couldn't you be prepared for prior to starting a couple of years ago at Brisbane?
Yeah. Oh, look, I think for me, having not played AFL, VFL footy, the idea of a 19, 20 year apprenticeship before I got a senior coaching job, it's probably been good for me, because I was able to do most roles. I've been a reserves coach, development coach, assistant coach, footy manager, done a lot of things in my time. So it sort of prepared me really well for the senior coaching role. And whilst there are times, sometimes I wish that maybe that could have happened 10 years ago, I don't regret the fact that I was 55 when I got my first job, because I think I was well truly ready for it.
Yeah, and so do I.
I'm saying that's how everyone should go about it. I think it's different for guys that have played at the highest level.
Why?
Because they've experienced the game. They've actually been out there and felt it. I haven't. What I've had to do is learn over a number of years what that looks and feels like, just getting to know AFL players and seeing the way... You know, I've been lucky I had Neil Danaher and Clarko to work with, so I've had a couple of great role models in terms of learning all the different sides of coaching.
So what does that mean for a young coach? I'm trying to think of one at your club or that you met. What advice would you say to him in light of the fact that it took you so long and you seem to be making a good fist of it?
Yeah, I would say don't be in too much of a rush. I think, you know, the world we live in now, everyone's in a hurry. I don't think you need to be. Just get as many experiences as you can and you'll wake up one day and you'll feel like you're ready, would be my advice. I certainly think, you know, you should be doing 5 to 8 years in assistant coaching development roles before you become a senior coach. I'd put that sort of timeline on it. I think that's important. And the other part of the question you asked me, what shocked you the most? Or I think it's that I played every other role in a footy department almost except the senior coaches. When you're in that chair and you're the one that's responsible and you have to answer all the questions, not only to the wider public and the media and all those sorts of things, but also to the 46 individual players that you coach and the coaches that work with and for you every day. Nothing prepares you for that.
Yeah.
You know, you go home some nights and Ursula's sitting there and she's wanting to talk when I walk in the door.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just feel like saying, can you just leave me alone for an hour? I don't want to talk to anyone. I've been talking all day. And
it can be a really lonely existence.
Yeah,
folks,
no,
it
is quite a lonely really job. Lonely. That's why you need a few people around you that you can actually talk to about it. And, you know, I'm fortunate with Ursula. We've been married for 30-odd years and I've been in footy the whole time and been a coach for most of that time or involved at a reasonably high level. So she's accustomed to it, but that's the one, you know. Like, I find myself going for a walk on a Friday before a Saturday game, and I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say at the press conference if we win. I'm thinking about what am I going to say if we lose, you know. How am I going to tell our story on this one and keep the place positive? Yeah. So it's that constant strain of trying to keep the ship going in the right direction, because it's really easy for it to not. I think that's the thing.
Folks, now tell us about the funniest moment you've ever had in the coach's box in your coaching career. While you just think of one, I'll just give you one. I was very fortunate that I worked with Barmy for a while, and Barmy, you know, could get pretty emotional about things, and we weren't going too flash at one time. We had Todd Viney not playing again, as usual, during this period of time. And we used to sit in the old members stand, the old smoker stand at the MCG, and the coach's box was in amongst it. And this bloke just non-stop, for the whole course of the game, non-stop, just kept giving it to Barmy. Barmy just kept giving it to him. Barmy opened the door and just responded back. And then he came back and said, Toddy, I'm going to give this bike 30 seconds and you're going to go out there and drag the bike in here and belt the living daylights out of him. In the course of a game, Barmy said that. Have you got anything as good as that?
I can remember those boxes. When I first started Melbourne, they were still there at the MCG. And in fact, my funny moment happened in that same box. It was the first or second year that I was coaching Melbourne Reserves, but it was a pretty tense game. And Greg Healy at the time was the chairman of selectors at Melbourne. He'd sit in the coach's box on match day for the reserves game. And I've picked the phone up and I'm sending this message down to the runner. And the runner's going, I can't hear. And I'm going nuts because the phone's not working. Then I look across to Greg Healy. He's laughing his head off. He said, why don't you turn it up the right way, you dickhead? So I was talking into the earpiece. No wonder I couldn't hear the bloke responding to me on the other end. So, that was pretty funny.
Last question, Fags. You've got a reputation within the ranks as being an inveterate reader, a library of sports books. I want you to give us your top two, the top two sports books that you've read in the last 12, 18 months that the punters, myself included, I'm always on the lookout for a good book. Tell us what's on your shelf.
There's a book I've just read recently called Culture Code. The same bloke, I can't remember the name of the author, I should, but he wrote the book called The Talent Code.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So this is a book he's sort of written about organisations and cultures and what makes them great. Yep. So I've read that recently and got a fair bit out of it. And the other one I read last year is a book called Ego is the Enemy. And they're probably not really coaching books in a sense, but they are if you read it, because one of the big things that you deal with in AFL footy is there's egos everywhere, and it's the ability to control egos for the greater good that can make you a really successful club. So that was a really interesting book to read. But yeah, I am a bit of a mad reader, and I drive all my coaches crazy. We do book studies during the pre-season, but I am fair. I just get them to read a chapter and do a summary of the chapter. They don't have to read the whole book if they don't want to, but there's a lot of good stuff out there, and you know, it's sometimes you get more out of reading a book than you do on going on an overseas trip, and a book costs you $30 usually, and a little bit of your time. So I've always been like that. You get a lot of knowledge out of it.
Well, look, folks, anybody that's listened to the last hour or so would think that Ego is the Enemy. Would not at all be surprised to hear that that's one of your favourite books, because you've demonstrated great candour and honesty, and Hutchie and I are lucky enough to know you for a long time, but Ego is certainly your enemy. Thank you for sharing so much of the journey that started on the gravel in Queenstown, Western Tasmania. On the behalf of all of the coaches, good luck for what lies ahead for the Brisbane Lions. And we all hope you continue to do such a fabulous job. Thanks for giving us your time.
Thanks, folks. Thanks, Hutchie, and thanks to the Coaches Association for all the good work you do for us coaches. We really appreciate it.